This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Kristen Eberhard, senior researcher at Sightline Institute. Kristen researches, writes about, and speaks about climate change and energy policy, and is an author of the Sightline blog, Cashing in Our Carbon. Before joining Sightline, she worked at Natural Resources Defense Council and taught courses on climate change and energy at Stanford Law School and UCLA School of Law. Kristen Eberhard is here today to tell us about the importance of putting a price on carbon in Oregon and Washington State and the best options to bring this about. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you.
Would you begin by saying a few words about Sightline Institute?
Sightline is the Pacific Northwest sustainability think tank. So we provide original research to help decision makers make the best informed decisions.
And now, what are the advantages of putting a price on carbon? Why is this a key step in addressing climate change?
Well, first, hopefully it goes without saying that we do need to address climate change. Climate change is affecting us right now here in Washington and Oregon. We've been seeing severe weather, fires, floods, landslides, huge hits to our shellfish industry, all happening now. So the need is urgent. And a price on carbon is an important way to do this. It works best with other complementary policies, but the price is the backstop that really starts shifting the economy away from dirty energy and towards clean energy by internalizing that pollution that right now is going into our atmosphere for free.
How widespread is pricing carbon worldwide?
Worldwide, by 2016, almost a quarter of all greenhouse gas emissions in the world will be priced. The big player there, of course, is China, who has committed to roll out a cap and trade program by 2016. They've already put in place 6 pilot projects in several of their bigger provinces. Each of those pilot projects is, of course, huge compared to the U.S., and by the time the national program rolls out, combined with the European program, programs in South Africa, Kazakhstan, of course, some pricing programs here in the U.S. and California and in the Northeast, as well as several pricing programs in Canada, Mexico, all those together will equal almost a quarter of all the emissions in the world.
To what extent do we have carbon pricing here in the U.S.?
So there's 2 big carbon pricing programs in the U.S. The one is to our south. California has a cap and trade program. They passed the bill in 2006. The program went into effect in 2012, so it has a couple of years of operation under its belt. The other big program is in the Northeast. There's 9 northeastern states that have a cap on emissions from the electricity sector, and that's been operating for almost 8 years now.
How successful has carbon pricing been, both worldwide and here in the U.S.?
So there's a long experience in Scandinavia that has been very successful at pushing down emissions. The 2 programs that are closest to us, you know, in the Northeast and in California, while there's not a ton of experience, you know, California has only 2 years, REGGIE is the Northeast program, has 8. But what both of those programs have shown is that they have reduced pollution while continuing to grow their economy at the same rate as the rest of the country. So they have been, in the years that they've been operating, very successful at doing exactly what we want to do, which is push down pollution and switch our economy to a cleaner energy economy.
What has been the scope of the carbon pricing mechanisms that have been put in place? What sectors are covered by the current plans?
So the Northeast program only covers electricity. And California's program covers almost all of the economy. Starting this year of 2015, they'll cover electricity, large industrial sources, as well as transportation fuels, which together account for 85% of all of the pollution in California.
What have been the challenges or difficulties for the carbon pricing systems that have been put into place?
Well, California faced a big challenge from the oil industry, which was unsurprisingly not happy about an effort to switch to a clean energy economy. So they poured a ton of money into a ballot initiative to try and overturn the California law. And California voters overwhelmingly, and by a 2/3 majority, rejected that attempt by the oil industry to maintain the status quo.
To price carbon, in your view, which is better, a carbon tax or a cap and trade system?
You know, they are two sides of the same coin. Both of them can accomplish the same thing, and both of them can face the same challenges. A cap starts out by saying, this is how much pollution we want to reduce, and we are only going to allow that much pollution to come into our atmosphere. And then it sort of feeds how much that will cost. A tax starts out saying, this is how much we're going to charge for pollution, and then we'll see how much pollution that actually reduces based on that price. So one has certainty about pollution, one has certainty about price, but both of them, in the end, just start sending the signal to the market that what we want is clean energy, and we don't want as much dirty energy, and just starts shifting things over time.
If you look at the programs that have already been put into place, has cap or trade or carbon tax worked better?
Well, both of the programs in the U.S. are cap and trade programs, and our neighbors to the north in British Columbia have a tax. With a cap and a tax, there's really the important questions to ask are how high is the price and how do you spend the money? So British Columbia has a slightly higher price than both California and the Northeast states. And it spends its money by shifting other taxes. So by saying we want to tax pollution because that's something we don't want, but we don't want to tax businesses and workers as much because we want businesses to supply jobs and we want workers to work. So it's reduced business taxes and income taxes while increasing the carbon tax. And that has been a very successful strategy for the economy. In California and in the Northeast states, they have spent a lot of the money on energy efficiency, which is another great strategy because energy efficiency is a very cheap way of reducing pollution while also really increasing people's quality of life because their houses work better, they have lower electricity bills, things are more comfortable, and that really starts to shift the economy away from dirty energy. So both strategies, as long as you spend the money in a way that helps people, both strategies have proven successful.
Would there be advantages of a carbon tax cap and trade hybrid system?
Yes, there's definitely ways to get the sort of the best of both worlds. So one possible way of doing that would be to have a tax that is bounded to sort of act more like a cap. So as I said, a tax, you pick the price and then you sort of see how much pollution that reduces. So one way of getting more guarantees around the pollution would to have a sort of preset self-adjustments to the tax. And Switzerland has actually done this, where they said, if we don't hit our pollution targets, we'll increase the tax by X amount. And if we overshoot our targets, we'll decrease the tax by this amount. And in that way, you get some certainty around the price because you know it's only going to go up and down by, you know, some percentage. But you also are more responsive to getting the actual pollution reductions that you want over time.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kristen Eberhard, senior researcher at Sightline Institute. Our topic is putting a price on carbon in Oregon and Washington State to address climate change. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your view, what are the best options for putting a price on carbon for Washington and Oregon?
In both states, either a tax or a cap could work. It's really a question of what is going to be politically viable. But from a policy standpoint, either of them could work. Now, I will say that there is a thumb on the scale in favor of a cap just because we do have this world-class cap already designed and already in place to ourselves. And it would be easy for us to just piggyback on the work that California has already done and join that cap without having to start from scratch. But that said, either one could work for Oregon or Washington.
Would you elaborate on the benefits or advantages of having a regional system rather than setting carbon pricing state by state?
Yeah, so we are not an island economically. And the most clear sector in which we are not an island is electricity. So Oregon and Washington both generate electricity in state and sell it out of state, and they also buy electricity from other states. So if you're trying to price carbon only within your state's borders, but then you're trading this electricity in and out of state, it becomes very messy, and it's there's several different prices, it's very hard for that market to operate and respond to the price in an efficient way. So if you have a regional program where, for example, California, Oregon, and Washington all had the same price, and they're all trading electricity with each other at the same price, it's much easier for the electricity suppliers to see, okay, that's the price, and so it makes sense for me to build, you know, new clean energy or to start shutting down these dirtier energy plants in response to that one single regional price.
What do you think the odds are of Washington being willing to join a regional system?
I'm not going to place a bet on that. I think that Governor Inslee has shown a lot of leadership in really recognizing the urgency of the threat of climate change to the state of Washington and really wanting to push forward with action. So I think that puts some good odds in Washington's favor that we have such leadership at the top to take action on this urgently. But then again, the most recent election did not do us any favors in the legislature in terms of support for joining a regional cap. So we'll see. We'll see what happens in the next 2 years.
And how about Oregon?
Oregon has the advantage of having both a governor who is supportive of taking action on climate change and hopefully a friendly legislature. So I would say that the chances of Oregon taking action on climate change are good.
If we don't in Washington join a cap and trade system, what are the odds of a carbon tax or other options?
Washington, aside from the, you know, urgent threat of climate change and its impact on the people of Washington, Washington also has a budget problem. And a carbon tax or a cap is a way that they could fill some of those holes that they're sort of desperately looking to fill right now to meet the court's mandate to fund education and other budget woes that they are facing. So it seems like taxing pollution, something that nobody wants to have more of, could be a way for them to both tax something bad and solve some of their budget problems.
Recently, the task force that Governor Inslee set up has given a report. What are the recommendations of his emissions reduction task force?
So his emission reduction task force said in sum that climate change is a problem and we should price it. They didn't really come down one way or the other on cap versus tax. They sort of laid out some of the pros and cons of each and how they could work and just said, we do need to take some action.
And what is your opinion of the report from the task force? How helpful is it?
It's a very helpful, sort of thoughtful consideration of what are the concerns in Washington and how could we address those. It was a very diverse group of people. It was 21 people from business, from labor, from public health. So I think a lot of the views of people in Washington were represented on the panel. And you can see that it goes through, everybody sort of got a chance to have input into the report. So in that sense, it's a very helpful overview of like everything that Washington needs to think about all laid out in one report.
What if our legislature fails to act on pricing carbon here in Washington?
That will be tragic. This problem is just going to keep getting worse. The things that we're seeing now with fires in the shellfish industry and floods, those are all just going to get worse and keep squeezing the people of Washington. So the longer that we wait to take action, just the harder it's going to get.
How much could be accomplished by regulation alone without pricing carbon?
Yeah, there's definitely a role for regulation, and there's definitely regulations that would work very well in concert with a carbon price. The problem with doing it all through regulation is that there's just too many pieces of the puzzle and there's lots of different agencies that have different roles for each sector. And so deciding how to give the right power to each agency to do the right thing, but then also to get them to work together, because a lot of the solutions are really synergistic. You know, for example, electric vehicles are a really important solution in the transportation sector to reducing pollution, but it requires some work together with the agencies that regulate electricity as well as agencies that are interested in transportation. And so a statewide approach that's backed by a cap and then complemented by some of the things that agencies can do would be the best approach. If you just leave the agencies out to dry, it's much harder for them to come up with a comprehensive and efficient way to reduce pollution across the state.
Would you give some specific examples of how that combination system might work?
A combination of a price plus regulation?
Yes.
So this is what both the Northeast states and California do. They have this cap, you know, that prices pollution. But then they also have targeted policies. Most notably, the most important ones are for energy efficiency. Because energy efficiency is already cheap. It's already a way to save money, even if you're not pricing carbon. And yet, all of those energy efficiency opportunities don't get taken already. So the price by itself isn't going to make that efficiency happening because the price is already right. But they already could save money. So there's other barriers to energy efficiency happening. So the way that a price and a targeted energy efficiency policy work together is the price sends the signal to the utilities and other investors who are building power plants that over time, carbon pollution is only going to get more expensive. So if you're thinking about building a power plant that's going to be in operation for 30 or 40 or 50 years, and you look out and you say, well, coal is going to get really expensive, and wind and solar just keep getting cheaper, and there's going to be this price on carbon, it pushes you to build a wind or a solar plant instead of another coal plant or another natural gas plant. And then that works in combination on the other side. The consumers get the benefit of energy efficiency policies where maybe they didn't have the money to buy a new efficient refrigerator, or maybe renters don't have the incentive to go and, you know, replace all their windows or insulate their homes because they might not be there in a few years because they're renters. So targeted energy efficiency policies help give them the money to do those things. So then they work together that now you have more efficient buildings, more efficient appliances and lighting, and those things are getting powered by cleaner power because you had a price and an energy efficiency policy.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kristen Eberhard, senior researcher at Sightline Institute. Our topic is putting a price on carbon in Oregon and Washington State to address climate change. What should be the price on carbon in Washington and Oregon to get the best benefit?
That depends a lot on what other complementary policies you have. So an economist did a report a couple years ago looking at how high the price would need to be if you only used a price in Washington. And it turns out that the price is really high if you're not getting those cheap options like energy efficiency. He estimated that the price would need to go up to $170 a ton by 2035. So I think that price is actually too high, because if you do some of these other policies, like making sure that you get the cheaper energy efficiency or making sure that you get at cheaper options for not having to drive so much, then the price doesn't need to be as high. So the prices around the world sort of cluster around $10 to $30 a ton. So that, I think, is sort of the sweet spot that Oregon and Washington should aim for, too. And I would say starting either at the California price, which right now is $13 a ton, or at the British Columbia price, which right now is $30 a ton, would be a great place to start to create this uniform regional price.
How about the effect on businesses? What can be done to help Washington and Oregon businesses that might be especially vulnerable to carbon pricing?
Yeah, so we looked at who those businesses are and what could be done for them. And what we discovered was that there's not that many businesses who are vulnerable to competition because of a carbon price. So the businesses that are vulnerable are ones that both have a really high energy cost in what they're doing, so often manufacturing, where they have a lot of energy that's going into the manufacturing. So any slight change in the cost of energy is going to impact them a lot. So they have to have that, plus also be facing competition from outside jurisdictions that have a price on carbon. So outside of Washington or, you know, hopefully eventually Oregon and California too. So when you take those two criteria, you say, okay, the energy price has to really affect them, and they're facing competition so that if they increase their prices, the competition is going to take them out. It's actually a pretty small percentage of businesses, and what we could do to help them is use some of the revenue from the tax or the cap and give it back to them to make sure that they are still able to be competitive in the global market.
Would you say more about your thoughts on using a revenue neutral system for carbon pricing?
Sure. Revenue neutral is what British Columbia does. They take in the money from the carbon tax, and then instead of using it to invest in new programs, they just use it to shift existing taxes so that government programs don't grow. The money just shifts around. And this is one great approach to the carbon pricing problem because it gives people who might be distrustful of new government programs, it assures them that there are no new government programs. It's that they are getting all of the money back in the form of tax breaks for their income tax or business tax. And the other benefit of it is, like you said, it's taxing the bads and not the goods. It's saying we're going to lower taxes on the things that we want, on work and employment, and raise the taxes on the things that we don't want, which is more pollution in our air.
And could you again expand on the advantages of having a system that does generate revenue?
Yeah, so the benefits of using the revenue for other programs is that you invest in the future, right? So there's a lot of things that with Oregon and Washington might want to do that will help our states function better in the future, but right now we just don't have the money for it. And so using that money to invest in, you know, energy efficiency that makes people's homes and businesses operate more comfortably, or investing in infrastructure that makes it easier to ride the bus or ride a train or ride your bike around, makes our region more economically vibrant in the future. So there's lots of great uses for the money that both reduce pollution and just make our region a better place to live going forward.
To what extent do you think money should be spent on new programs as opposed to giving dividends back to citizens?
So dividends is different than revenue neutral. The revenue neutral just sort of reduces your taxes, whereas a dividend would actually mean people would get a check in the mail every year or every quarter. Similar to what the Alaska Fund does with oil money, everybody in Alaska gets a check every year. So the benefits of that system of giving everybody a check every year is that everybody sees very tangibly the benefits, where a revenue neutral system, sometimes people don't notice that their taxes went down from one year to the next because lots of things change from one year to the next. So they might not remember, oh, I am personally seeing a benefit from this carbon pricing program because it's lost in the noise. Whereas getting a check in the mail, as that happens, you know, every quarter for a couple of years, pretty soon you get used to, I am benefiting from this. Polluters are using our common atmosphere to pollute, and now they're paying me for, you know, use of a resource that I have ownership in. So it sort of changes the mindset or the relationship between people and the carbon price, that it's no longer just sort of this anonymous, you know, government program, but they have a stake in it personally because they are getting a check.
How would the different programs likely affect low-income people?
All of the programs, the examples here in North America, British Columbia, California, and the Northeast states, all of them are slightly regressive for low-income people, which is the bad news. But the good news is it's really easy to fix that. It takes a very small percentage of the money to give back to people, either in the form of a working tax credit or simply a rebate or investing in those communities to make sure that they are actually getting benefits. And it takes maybe 20 or 25% of the money to completely make low-income people whole from the program. Unfortunately, none of the programs have taken quite that step. All of them have some things in place to help low-income people, but none of them have made it completely progressive yet. That's something that Washington and Oregon could be leaders on, is pricing carbon, but making sure that it is a progressive program.
Are there other issues that Washington and Oregon should be aware of in putting their programs into place?
I think we've hit on all the big ones. So, you know, the first one is just setting the price right to make sure that it actually sends the signal to the market to invest in clean energy and not in dirty. And then using the money for something good. And, you know, we talked about there's really three different ways to do that. You know, reducing people's other taxes or giving them a check or investing in the future of the state. So how high is the price? What do you spend the money on? And then making sure that you're not harming people in the state. So not harming businesses that might face competition and not harming low-income people who spend more of their money on energy than higher-income people. I mean, those are sort of the big concerns for the state. And then I'd say just the one other thing that Washington and Oregon should be thinking about is how their program is spurring change globally. So Washington and Oregon are affected by climate change, and it's important for us to take action, but we can't do it by ourselves. And so any program that we put in place should really be designed with an eye to, is this going to help other states, other countries follow suit so that we eventually have a worldwide effort to stop climate change?
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
This is an urgent problem that's facing us right now, and we have a moment right now in both Washington and Oregon to take action on it, and to take an action that would really spur momentum, because it would create potentially this regional block that the entire West Coast, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and California would create this block against climate change. And we could do it now in the next 2 years.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kristen.
Thank you.
You were just listening to Kristen Eberhard, Senior Researcher at Sightline Institute. For more information, check on the web at sightline.org. Again, that's sightline.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM. And KEXP.org.